Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. For most of our program today, we're going to be talking about homeless children in America, which is now at an all-time high. But we didn't want to ignore the decision by the St. Louis County Grand Jury, meeting for 25 days over 3 months, hearing 70 hours of testimony from 60 witnesses, many of whom gave conflicting statements before they decided last night, the announcement was made, not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. And many of us watched the news conference and then the subsequent disturbances that took place mostly in Ferguson last night. So we wanted to have a chance to find out what happened last night. People are just pouring through now the testimony, particularly of Darren Wilson, the police officer. And we wanted to talk once again with a wonderful guest who was with us on August 14, Ishmael Sistrunk. He's a columnist for the St. Louis American. He grew up in St. Louis County, and he talked when he was last with us about being stopped by the police on many occasions for no apparent reason. The last time, which sticks in my mind, was he was driving and was pulled over for having snow on his license plate, and it was snowing. So he's going to be with us. He was up all night doing live streaming for the place that he works, and it's the St. Louis American. He is a Mizzou graduate and tweeted last night that making the announcement in the dark of the night was not a very bright idea, no pun intended, so reckless that it seems intentional. So we're going to start our show, and we'll give you a chance to respond to the grand jury's decision in the first part of our program today. Get your calls in early. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And later in the hour, America's Youngest Outcasts. Ishmael, thank you very much for joining us. And I know you've had probably zero sleep because you were covering events last night. Thank you for being with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So you were in Ferguson last night. Tell me what you witnessed last night, Ishmael.
Well, last night I personally was not in Ferguson. There were some other reporters from the St. Louis American and photographers that were on the scene in Ferguson. I actually went to one of the other protests in South City off Shaw and Grant, which is near where Vondrett Myers was killed. And that's where I did my live streaming from, because by the time I got out, it was already, just a disaster in Ferguson where the looting, the tear gas, the fires, all of that was going on. So I just decided to go down onto the other protests. And still was able to get some footage there.
Mm-hmm. And what sense did you have from the protesters? Tell me how it unfolded last night. Did people absorb the news? And then what actions did they take? Were people angry immediately, or were they taking it all in? How did it all happen?
Yeah, I think people were immediately angry, but the verdict was widely expected. I think I knew one person who expected there to be an indictment, but pretty much everyone knew what was coming. So I think there were two factions. There was a large group of people who were already out in Ferguson and in other areas at the time of the announcement. And then there were other people who, may have watched from home or watched somewhere else and then went down to join the protest or the other activities that were going on.
Mm-hmm. And when you say it was widely expected, why was that the case?
I think just the way that this situation has played out, there's never really been a trust in the prosecutor, Bob McCullough. In his 20-plus years as a prosecutor, he's never indicted a police officer, as I understand it. So there was always this distrust with the process. So no one really ever expected an indictment. I think people were hopeful, that it might change this time, but it wasn't. And so people reacted to that angrily.
One would hope, no matter what you think about this particular case, but all cases like this, and unfortunately there have been too many like this, that there were some kind of court procedure so that you could find out what the truth was, because what we're left with today is the release of all of this testimony, and everybody's most centered on Darren Wilson's testimony, which of course you would want to have somebody question him about, because his testimony, in addition to eyewitnesses, seems to be inconsistent.
Right, absolutely. And I haven't had a chance to really crawl through that information that's been released. I've seen bits and pieces of it, but it is telling that there really wasn't a strong cross-examination of Darren Wilson. And you would expect if there's a prosecutor on board that they're going to do a thorough cross-examination. I think last night when we saw McCullough speak on the news, he discredited pretty much all the witnesses other than Darren Wilson. So, you know, that again just kind of adds to the mistrust that people have had towards that office and just towards this whole case in general.
Mm-hmm. The other aspect of the case that's very interesting is the discretion, and I'm not sure if it's a discretion that goes state by state or if it's a constitutional issue, if the Constitution and the Supreme Court has weighed in on this, but the amount of discretion that a police officer has, it would seem to me, if you were in this situation, fairly easy to say, I felt as though my life was threatened, and so I had to take this action. And that seems to be the defense that's used, and nobody really questions that.
Right, and it seems that I've seen numerous sheriffs or police officers in interviews, and, I mean, they all pretty much say that the training is to shoot to kill. You know, if you have to shoot in any type of situation, shoot to kill, you don't shoot to injure, you don't shoot to discourage. And so I think that training policy needs to be addressed because if we value humanity, you know, their officers should be able to decide, you know, what type of threat they're really up against. But if you just tell them shoot to kill every time, that just doesn't value life. It doesn't seem to value life.
Mm-hmm. There is a Department of Justice investigation going on as well. Do you have any idea, Ishmael, how that's progressing, when we may be able to hear what their report is?
I do not know. I think the civil rights portion of the of their investigation, from what we're hearing, is they've decided not to pursue further with that. Now, I think there is another ongoing aspect of the federal investigation, but we haven't gotten any news on to what to expect or how long that will go. But I do know the civil rights part is they've given up on that.
Mm-hmm. You made a tweet last night saying making the announcement in the dark of night was not a very bright idea, so reckless that it seems intentional. Do you know why the announcement was made at 8:15 in the evening?
I don't, and nobody else that I've talked to really understands that. If you want to have peace, and it just doesn't make sense to make that announcement at night. There's understandable. There's going to be anger, and when you do it in darkness like that, it just gives the people who do have malicious intentions, it gives them that opportunity in the darkness. So I know earlier in the week we were told that if there was no decision by the grand jury by Saturday, that they will wait until after the Thanksgiving holiday. But sometime between Saturday and Monday, that changed, and they just released it, I guess, as soon as it was announced.
Mm-hmm. What will the reporters on your paper be dealing with tonight? What do you expect tonight? Do you have any idea?
We don't. We know that there are, you know, actions that were already planned in the works. I'm actually at one right now. I'm not sure if you can hear in the background, but I'm at Keener Plaza in downtown St. Louis, where there's a pretty large protest that's going on. So we expect there to be many organized protests, and then we expect that, you know, there will be unorganized protests as well. So we're just really playing it by ear. We're plugged into different protest, I guess, chat lines on the phone where you get a text message, or their website. So we're lucky with the St. Louis American, where we have a good relationship with the law enforcement and the protesters, excuse me. Mm-hmm. So we'll be covering whatever's there.
And I believe your paper was reporting today that the protests are not limited to your area, but there are protests or have been protests in some 100 cities all over the country.
Yes, yes. There have been protests in New York. There's been protests in San Francisco and everywhere in between. And the reason is because this isn't just a St. Louis issue. This isn't a Ferguson issue. We continually see young black males that are killed, whether it's by law enforcement or others, and there just doesn't seem to be just prosecution for that. There doesn't seem to be a concern for that life. So this is a national and international thing now where people are joining the movement and showing their support.
As someone who grew up in Ferguson, would you say it's particularly egregious in Ferguson, though?
Well, I think it's particularly egregious in St. Louis County in general. I grew up right outside of Ferguson, but I have family there. I go through there all the time, even now. But this is something throughout the entire St. Louis County, especially North County area, where there's just this unfairness that everyone feels. It's been no secret. Like I said, I think when I was on your show before, it really wasn't a surprise. With the initial riots, and it wasn't a surprise for me, at least, to see what happened last night.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think needs to, I don't even know where people go from here, but there were questions before this. Now there are probably twice as many questions as a result of all this testimony. Where do people go to get all those questions answered, or do you fear that they will never be answered?
I don't know. That's a great question. I think the biggest step that needs to be taken is we need to be able to have open, honest dialogue. It seems like in today's society that's hard to do. It's like an us versus them type of mentality that mm-hmm. people have. And so, when you get into issues about race or unfairness, you have to be able to talk about that. You have to be able to express your opinion and, take other people's account into perspective. So until we're able to have those open discussions and it's not just, you're wrong, I'm right, you're wrong, or whatever, I don't think there will really be progress.
Yeah, and certainly in this case, everybody would like to know what exactly the whole truth is. We have time for maybe a couple phone calls. We're moving to another subject, but we didn't want to ignore the grand jury decision. Ishmael Sistrunk was with us in August. He's with us again today. He is a columnist for the St. Louis American and was covering protests just outside St. Louis last night. We'll be welcoming phone calls, but you need to call right now. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. And we'll go to Jill in Rhinelander. Hi, Jill.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have one comment, and that is if everybody did what they were supposed to do, we wouldn't be having these issues.
Thank you. What do you mean by that? Everybody did what they were supposed to do. I'm not sure what she means other than we need to all... abide by the law. I think that there's another element here, though, and that's that whether or not the police department is abiding by the law as well and has when it comes to issues of race in Ferguson and in other communities. I mean, there's a whole history here that you can't ignore of people being picked up because they're black, they're not doing anything wrong. You told us the story of you had snow on your license plate and you got pulled over because you had snow on your license plate and it was snowing. I mean, we have to look at all that as well, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, certain people do make that comment, and I think what you may have meant, and I don't want to speculate, is that, if there were no issues legally, we saw about what happened in the store. If Mike Brown had been following the law, then none of this would have happened. But you can look at other situations. I think the John Crawford, where he had a BB gun in Walmart, and he was gunned down for it. So he was doing nothing that was illegal, yet he was killed, and the officers were not prosecuted. They got off. So we see instances a lot of times where that's not the case. You don't have to be doing wrong. And even if you are, you know, the big question is, again, that value of life. Should someone be killed because they are committing a crime, or should they go and face, you know, a trial and a jury of their peers?
Yeah. And do you know if there has been, in the area that you were reporting from, has there been a lot of seminars on police training, on when to use force, on what alternatives to force might be available? People have had several months now in St. Louis County to look at what we might do differently, haven't they?
Yes, but to answer your question, no. I mean, the standard police training, as I mentioned earlier, is shoot to kill. And it seems that that strategy is not going to change. Now, they did make some adjustments in how they handled the protesters, where they allow people for a while to block the street, or they may have sat by while people threw things like plastic bottles that weren't really dangerous, whereas back in August, you know, they advanced on the crowd then. So there has been a change in tactics dealing with protesters, but the actual training that they get on how to police, they're happy with how it's going, and they don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Mm. Pam in Madison. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I've got a question. Early on, I noticed that the chief of police in Ferguson has a Chicago accent. And then shortly after that, Newsweek released the revenue figures generated by the Ferguson Police Department. And they spiked in 2010 at the same time he was hired. Do we know how he was recruited or what he was told his job was?
I'm not sure. I'm not aware of how he was recruited or any of that information specifically on him. But I can tell you that in St. Louis County, it's widely known that I think there are 98 municipalities or something like that, which are different cities. Some have, you know, as little as 400 people up to 10,000. But in each of these municipalities, it's really revenue driven, which is why people are pulled over so much and get tickets, because the cities, all the different cities, they really rely on the revenue of ticketing and things like that.
Thanks, Pam, for your call. And we'll take one more call for you, Ishmael. It's Jody in Superior. Hi, Jody.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm just going to clarify something with your speaker. Officers are not directed to shoot to kill. It is they have to meet a deadly force requirement with the imminent threat of great bodily injury or death to yourself or another. The officer is directed to use deadly force. It's not an. It's not. Once a threat is stopped, an officer has to administer first aid to the victim or the shooting suspect.
But is it not the case, Jody, that the police officer has a lot of discretion when it comes to deciding?
Absolutely. If no other means would have been effective to walk away, to run, to go for cover, you have to remember this is happening in a split second.
Right.
And it's not a suggestion. The officer is directed, commanded to use deadly force.
Ishmael.
Well, what I was quoting is information that I've heard directly from police officers and sheriffs. There was a sheriff from St. Clair County, which is right across the river in Illinois, yesterday, who did an interview, and that's what he said, is that we are trained to shoot to kill. So that wasn't my opinion. That was specifically what officers are saying. And I think, you know, when you look in this situation, Mike Brown was unarmed, so you would imagine that there was a way to, even if there was some type of altercation, that was a way to neutralize the situation that didn't involve shooting him in the head. You know, and I think if you look back around the same time Mike Brown was shot, and I'll be brief, there was an issue in San Diego where there was a Caucasian gentleman, older, who was waving a gun at women, children, and police officers. And he was eventually, after an hour negotiation, he was shot, I believe, in the leg, and he lived and he was arrested afterwards. But what the black community is not seeing is that same treatment, that same value of life.
There were a lot of shots fired in this case, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if that's the issue of once the person is down or neutralized that the officer should give first aid. That didn't happen in this situation, at least not from the evidence that I've heard or seen. Again, I haven't pored over what Prosecutor McCullough laid out last night, but that doesn't seem like that was how it happened here in St. Louis. So I believe that's how it should happen, but that's not how always. That's not how it does in practice. And I think that even if you don't agree with what happened, you have to have your eyes open and see that things aren't always as they seem.
Mm-hmm. Right. And on that note, which is sums up everything, things are not always as they seem. The quest for the truth will continue. Ishmael, thank you very much for being with us.
All right. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Ishmael Sistrunk joined us last in August, shortly after the shooting and death of Michael Brown. He's a columnist for the St. Louis American and has special eyes and ears for this story because, as you heard him say, he grew up in St. Louis County and has a lot of relatives who live in Ferguson and has been in and out of Ferguson for his whole life. So he was covering demonstrations last night for the St. Louis American. Thanks for your call, Judy. Thanks for all of your calls. We will pause for just one moment and change our subjects. We wanted to talk about what happened last night, the grand jury decision, and give you a chance to respond. And now, in a moment, we will talk about the number of homeless children in America. Child homelessness increased by 8% nationally in this country from 2012 to 2013. Where is it very bad? Why has homelessness increased? What are the reasons for homelessness? We'll talk about all of that as we continue here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We turn our attention now to a serious topic and an increasing problem of homelessness among children in this country. America's Youngest Outcasts is an examination of child homelessness nationally and in the 50 states and District of Columbia, just released by the National Center on Family Homelessness. And we're going to be talking about the findings this part of the program with Dr. Carmela De Candia, the director of the National Center on Family Homelessness. Dr. De Candia is a licensed clinical psychologist with specialties in trauma, child and adolescent development, and assessment and program development. She's worked with underserved populations for her whole career, including young parents and children and families who are experiencing homelessness and trauma, as well as those involved in the child welfare system. Dr. De Candia, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
It's really amazing to me that you would have thought that we were taking on this problem. It's astounding that child homelessness increased by 8% nationally from 2012 to 2013. How could that be?
Yeah, you know, the numbers, I think, have caused a bit of alarm. I think we've known, those of us who've worked in the field, known that for three decades, the numbers have gone up steadily. But really, we've just seen such dramatic increases in more recent times. So now we're at a point where in the 2013 school year, 2.5 million children experienced homelessness at some point in the 2013 year. That's one in 30 children. And when you think about, you know, your kind of average public school classroom, that's one child in every classroom. That's a lot of kids who don't have a place to call home tonight.
Mm. And imagine how difficult it is to learn or go to school, even get to school if you're in that living situation.
Yeah, it can be a very difficult situation. We often say that, you know, we talk a lot about trauma these days, and we talk a lot about the types of trauma that people experience, but homelessness itself is a trauma. And, you know, one thing about that people may not realize about the homeless child population is that 51%, so just over half of the homeless child population, is under age 6. Mm. We're talking about very young kids for the majority of kids experiencing homelessness. And when you think about that kind of instability, you know, not having kind of kids need predictability, routine. Those things mean safety to children. And when you don't have that, And you might not be getting the kind of regular sleep or the kind of regular nutrition that you need, and you're worrying all the time, and then you have to go to school the next day and try and concentrate. It can be a really difficult issue for kids.
Mm-hmm. You also say in the report that some progress has been made in reducing homelessness among veterans and also chronically homeless individuals, but not in the category that we're talking about. Why in those areas have we been able to reduce homelessness?
Yeah, well, you know, a little background first that, you know, for years there's been a bit of a national disagreement about what defines family homelessness or child and family homelessness. Mm. And so there are two definitions. The Department of Education's definition of child homelessness, which is used by the majority of other eight federal agencies, HHS, Department of Labor, they define family homelessness as not just families that might be living in a shelter or in an unsheltered situation, so they might be in their car or a campground type setting, but also families that are doubled up. So they're moving in with families and friends. They sometimes split their family up because to temporarily stay with someone, and they're moving around fairly frequently. And that actually accounts for 75% of the homeless family population. Another definition that is used by the Department of Housing and Urban Development is more restricted. So it really looks at sheltered or unsheltered families, families that might be in unsheltered situations, which really isn't the majority. That's not really, you don't see families and kids on the street. You know, it's a very small number. But they do count families that are in shelters that are within their continuum of care. So we have these two definitions, and when you look at the two definitions, HUD counts children at one point in time, one night in January. They're doing an annual homeless count. But those numbers are misleading because they're really not capturing the 75% of families that are doubled up.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the fact we have these two definitions, and then we look at how do we target our resources. But if we're targeting our resources towards a restricted number, we're not really targeting resources to really effectively impact the large scope of the problem. And what we've seen is that when you do target the resources effectively, the numbers come down.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen the decline in individuals who are chronically homeless and living on the street, and certainly our homeless veterans. Lots of resources have been targeted from the previous and current administrations towards really bringing the numbers down in those populations. So we know that how to do it, but the same attention and the same level of resource towards the real size of the problem hasn't been directed towards kids and families.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so it's not a surprise the numbers have gone up.
Yeah. I was reading some statements from the director of the California Homeless Youth Project, where one in five of the total number of people who are homeless are in California, which is at first hard to believe, except then you realize how expensive it is to live in many cities in California. And she was saying that, as you were just talking about, one family in extreme poverty lives with another family in extreme poverty. So the children are sleeping in closets, in kitchens, in bathrooms, in other parts of a house, a lot of people.
Right. And we, you know, I say that this is an invisible group. You're not necessarily seeing them. So you might not necessarily realize how much this is happening in your own community, because these families, these moms, and typically it's a mom and her young children, they'll go to any length to make sure that their children have a safe place to stay for that night. So they're really moving around a lot. And these kids are often in, you know, households that are already stressed themselves and trying to help out, but they're stressful situations. And so it can be a bit of an invisible problem, and these kids have been fairly invisible and quite neglected by our society for some time now.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, one thing that immediately comes to mind is you need housing that's affordable. And I'm wondering what's happened over whatever statistics you have, whatever length of time, to create low-income housing in this country.
Yeah, well, we know that the real driver of child homelessness is poverty. You know, the difference between you know, often if you look at a state minimum wage, which is what maybe a mother, a young mother with limited education and limited employment history might be earning to support her two children, which is a typical profile for a homeless family. She's living in poverty and she's making a very low minimum wage. But when you look at the cost of housing across most states, the income needed for a two-bedroom apartment is often two, three times that. California, there's a big disparity, as there are in many states. So as the cost of housing has really outpaced the income, particularly for this kind of most vulnerable group, you see a higher and higher percentage of households that are paying more than 50% of their income for rent. It doesn't leave a lot left over for childcare, especially when you have young children, for the necessities of life. And often I've seen a family, they can have one, you know, missed rent payment or one medical issue for their child that causes them to miss some work, and they miss a rent payment, and that can kind of start the cascade of events that leads right into homelessness.
Mm. Well, you have to believe if you do find work and if you don't have the skills or very much education, you mentioned a mom and her children, child care can be prohibitively expensive and very hard to find. And then you got the sickness factor. If your child gets sick, you can't go to work, and you're making in some areas $7.25 an hour. How are you going to do it?
Exactly. I mean, child care, that's why, you know, when you think about child and family homelessness, within the overall homeless population, there are different subgroups. And we have to recognize that these groups have different needs. The needs of an individual adult versus the needs of a family with very young children, obviously the kind of service needs that are required are going to be different. Child care, obviously, is one of the greatest needs that young families have. And it can be extremely expensive. It's difficult to get vouchers to be able to help support that. And so sometimes you see mothers have to leave work and kind of become homeless in order to be able to take care of their child. They're forced with making very, very difficult choices that because of some of the predicaments. But we always say that housing and affordable housing is essential. You know, we have to find ways to kind of make housing more affordable for families that are living so far below the poverty line. But housing alone is not going to be enough. Families need kind of support services to help them get through. Child care is a perfect example of kind of the structural supports that families might need. Even the best resource family has a support system, whether it's structural supports like getting a ride, transportation, as well as emotional supports. And many families, particularly these young moms, may have a history of domestic violence. It's a very high percentage of families that have domestic violence, whether as a precursor, immediate precursor into homelessness, or somewhere in their history. And it can often kind of, that kind of trauma can kind of prolong the experience of homelessness, as a mom might have lost her support systems and her economic ability to earn a job. And that has to be rebuilt. It's a little bit of a long ramp, and services are needed to help these families. The best way to support these kids is to support their parents, job skills, child care, counseling services, whatever those kind of things they need. We support the parents. They're in the best position to support their children.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is Dr. Carmela De Candia. She is director of the National Center on Family Homelessness, and a report has just been released that looks at the increasing number of children who are homeless in this country. One child in every 30, as she said, it would be one child in each classroom around this country. Nearly 2.5 million children were homeless at some point in 2013. The problem is particularly severe in certain states. There are statistics for Wisconsin, which of course we'll explore. We'll look at the best states and why they're the best in terms of addressing these issues, and the worst states and why they're the worst, and welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well at K Dunn Show. Dr. De Candia is a licensed clinical psychologist with specialties in trauma, child and adolescent development, program development, and assessment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Carl in Madison, our first caller for you. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. I read not long ago a book by Barbara Ehrenreich that many may be familiar with called Nickeled and Dimed, and it was her experiment of taking a year to work at a minimum wage level and even allowing herself a car that sort of was outside the equation and that she kept running well. She found it extremely difficult to make ends meet, and some of her assumptions about people at the bottom, she said that she thought people would say, oh, what are you doing here? You know, you're so bright and effervescent. And she said no one ever said that to her, and she found other really capable, wonderful people struggling at the bottom. And one of these people, a waitress, was living in a hotel, and Barbara just said, you know, hey, let me tell you, it's a lot cheaper living in an apartment. And the woman looked at her with a bemused smile and said, do you think if I had the first and last month's rent, the security deposit, I wouldn't do that in 5 seconds? And she just really became aware that this isn't about judging people at the bottom who just don't have what the rest of us have. And if they were as together as we were, we'd all be set. It's really, once you get down to that level, in a country with as much wealth in it as the United States, we've got a whole population of people that, bright as they may be, capable, gifted, human as they may be, they cannot climb out of poverty given the meager handholds we're handing down.
Mm-hmm. I read that book as well, Carl, and she was on some years ago, and she was doing all of that by herself, right? Can you imagine doing that with children?
Yes, and again, the car was kept running perfectly. She didn't have any of those, you know, those things that jump up and bite you. And so many people in this country, myself included, are not that far away from finding ourselves in similar position. And, you know, there but for the grace of God go I. But we really are, you know, the sense of the common good and who we are as a country as we watch the wealth get further and further out of reach for so many, so that so few can have what they have. And we've conflated capitalism and democracy in a way that's just, this has to turn around. And looking at the numbers and what the guest is describing, it has to turn around soon.
Thank you, Carl, for your call. Dr. DeCandia.
Yes, you know, your caller mentioned something about the response that the person who did this experience, the idea of how people are looked at. And I've heard many times this kind of belief, it's almost some kind of stigma or stereotype people carry around that somehow people have brought this on themselves, that if they just chose to work hard, they could do this, and that they're somehow, or they're gaming the system. I can tell you that nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, I have never met a mother who has parented kids and chosen to be homeless. They work so hard to shield and buffer and try and protect their kids from this experience. And as you said, you know, when you really work with families that are struggling in this way, their resilience is extraordinary, really, for the amount of adversity that they're going through and what they're trying to do, and what these moms in particular are trying to do. I mean, certainly there are two-parent families and single dads as well, but they're working very hard, and their resilience to overcome some of these things is really quite extraordinary. There are a lot of structural obstacles in their way, and when you are parenting young children, and a lot of homeless moms are in their 20s, and the majority are in their mid to late 20s, and they have very young children, often under age 6. So, you know, the climb out of poverty when you don't have the resources and there are a lot of obstacles in your way can be a difficult climb.
Marley is next in Green Bay. Hi, Marley. Are you there, Marley?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just would like to say that we can say how awful it is, but it all comes back down to this. It's economics, and it's the haves and the have-nots, and the haves are hanging on dearly to everything they have. All you have to do is look at the stock market. And then you have this minimum wage that is so unbelievable and so chaotic, but nobody wants to change the minimum wage. How do we expect these people to get out of this poverty? And then it's this adoration of anything private is to be honored, but anything public is to be scorned, whether it's public housing, public health, or public education. When are we going to wake up to what we're doing in this United States of America, and certainly in this state of Wisconsin, where we just voted for all the wrong people?
Dr. Day Candia.
You know, the idea that in a nation, I think one of your other caller had said this, a nation that has such wealth and opportunity that tonight 2.5 million children don't have a place to call home, it is a tragedy. The federal government has a plan called Opening Doors, and there's a federal goal to end child and family homelessness by 2020. The issue, I believe, is that we at this point really need the political will to make child homelessness a national priority, because it has to come to the point where we really look at the size and scope of the problem and really take some active, decisive action and some real steps to think about how we target our resources to address that issue. The fear is that as the numbers are climbing, if we don't take that action soon, the goal of ending child homelessness by 2020 might soon be out of reach.
Thank you, Marley, very much for your call. I want to get to this state-by-state analysis where Wisconsin ranks. You looked at a number of factors, the extent of child homelessness, the risk for homelessness, child well-being, state and policy and planning. Do you have the Wisconsin numbers close to you?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good. How do we fare?
So Wisconsin fares actually pretty well compared to the other states. I mean, what we do, as you mentioned, is we use these four domains, extent, risk factors, overall child well-being, and state efforts. And there are a number of different data points that go into each subdomain, but they all come together to provide a composite state ranking. So Wisconsin ranks 18th out of 50, with one being the best and 50 being the worst. Not bad, considering kind of how, you know, the scope of how the problem can play out in different states. And it's all relative to what's happening in that state and state populations. The numbers have gone up in Wisconsin. If you look back at the 2010 numbers, where there were almost 26,000 homeless children, and in our most recent U.S. Department of Education data from 2013, they've gone up to 32. So the numbers are creeping up for Wisconsin. But the risk factors aren't as high, they're still there, but they're not as high relative to other states. About 19% of households are paying more than 50% of their income in Wisconsin. About 18% of children are living in poverty. And the income needed for a two-bedroom apartment is closer to $15 an hour versus the state minimum wage of $7.25. So it's almost, a little more than a two-fold difference. Relative to other states, it's not as high, but still you can see what some of those disparities are. I think the biggest issue for Wisconsin, where the ranking was not as great, was in the state policy and planning efforts, where Wisconsin ranked 37th. And what we look for there are a couple of things. Sort of the biggies have to do with the number of housing units that are available for families, whether there's a state housing trust fund, which Wisconsin had, but we really look at, what kind of statewide planning efforts have taken place. Is there an interagency council at the state level, similar to what's at the federal level? And is there a state plan that really has an extensive focus on the needs of children and families, which, as we've just discussed, they have unique needs. And those are areas that are not developed at this point for Wisconsin. And so those are areas where, when you look at states that have ranked higher in terms of, say, the top three, Minnesota, Nebraska, Massachusetts, Iowa, their state planning efforts and their interagency councils are not only set up, including all departments across the state, but they're quite active. And they have state plans that have sections that have an extensive focus on the needs of children and families. So we know that states can do a lot, but like anything else, you have to get the plan in place, you have to get the people around the table, you have to make it a statewide effort, and you have to set goals that you then work towards.
Mm-hmm. And Minnesota is number one, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Hmm. Yes, it is. According to all domains put together.
Right.
Yeah.
John in Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, this stuff is very interesting that we've been talking about, and it sounds like you need Huey Long's plans of the 1930s, although we don't have families like we used to, where 99% of the families stayed together. But at his program was tax the ultra-wealthy and give every family a homestead with a home, an automobile, a radio, and all the comforts of the home. For that family's ownership forever until it expires. But to do that, you have to tax the ultra wealthy, and they could have eliminated the depression in a year or two if they would have adopted Huey Long's program. But of course, they murdered him instead. So, just would you comment on his program?
Well, what I know is that the last time we had high numbers of homeless families was the Great Depression. Really not since that time were the numbers as large, and really it was about in the 1980s where the numbers started going up again. But before that, it was the issues related to poverty and the depression. And we do have to look at how we construct our policies and our resources to helping those most in need. I mean, it is a question for our nation. Will we take those steps?
And when he talks about getting everybody a home, I know there are some rather innovative programs in this city, in Milwaukee, and in other parts of the country, where when people look at this issue, they say immediately, okay, the first thing we're going to do is give people a home. And there aren't great numbers of communities doing that. But is that how you tackle the problem? Is it give somebody a home, or is it to lead a drive to get the minimum wage much higher, or is it to get skill training? Do you have to start somewhere, and if so, where?
Right. Well, homelessness is the experience itself is not good for kids. And the faster we can stabilize a family, the better. Kids need that stable place so they have a roof over their head. They start to feel safe. They don't worry. They can start, families can have routines. So the sooner we get families into housing, the better. And there are a lot of programs called rapid rehousing that are being used and tried for families. The principle being, really putting a lot of efforts into getting families stabilized and rapidly rehoused, and getting them kind of in that safe home as quickly as possible. Then we have to complement that with services, really get them in that kind of affordable housing. But for them to remain residentially stable, because we do know that once families get into housing, they can not be stable, and they can move around still a lot as they're struggling to stabilize. So that's where the employment skills, the child care resources, sometimes transportation, getting into school to get your GED or high school diploma so you can get that better paying job. And we do know that we need to address sometimes underlying trauma issues that might have started before homelessness or might have occurred during the experience itself. Mm-hmm. We do want to assess, and one thing I do recommend is that whenever a child is identified as being homeless, we want to assess every child, because the sooner we can identify whether there has been any impact, and usually there's some sort of developmental impact, particularly for young children, we can get early intervention in place. And early intervention works for kids, especially when they're under age 6. When we can get that kind of service early on, you can literally change the trajectory of their development and get them back on track.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for being with us. I think we have this on our Facebook page, don't we, Scotty? The report's on our Facebook page, so people can look at it. And thank you very much. It's certainly an underreported story, Dr. DeCandia, and I'm thankful for you to be with us. It's not a pleasant story, but it's good to draw attention to it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Our guest this part of the program, Dr. Carmela DeCandia, and she is director of the National Center on Family Homelessness. Their report has just been released. It is titled America's Youngest Outcasts and is an examination of child homelessness nationally in the 50 states and in the District of Columbia. It uses the newest federal and state data related to child homelessness, including the number of homeless children in public schools made by the Department of Education for the 2012-2013 school year. All right, covered a lot of territory this hour. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing our piece on Ferguson, Missouri, and the grand jury decision. And thanks to K.P. Whaley for this segment on child homelessness. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production and for help with production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. News is coming up momentarily from National Public Radio. And then we'll continue and talk about Jackie Kennedy, hour two of our program for this Tuesday.